Members, we're going to come to order. And first item of business is a few minutes here, and I'm wondering if our minority Lee Johnson, since you raised the issue and asked the question about our minutes from last year, if you would be so kind as to move our minutes from the April 24th meeting. Members, these are in your packet.
I will move those minutes.
So moved. Any discussion? If not, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Johnson, we also have the May 13th minutes from 2019. If you would be so kind to move those, I'd appreciate it.
I will move them.
Very well. Representative Johnson moves the minutes from May 13th. Any discussion? If not, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. And Representative Edelson, we have the minutes from February 11th. And I'm hoping that you would be kind to move those minutes for us. The February 11th minutes have been moved. Any discussion? If not, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Members, we've got a pretty busy agenda, and I'm hoping that we can move pretty efficiently throughout them. But before we do, let me just go back to the last meeting where I talked about the where I referenced the Rule 4.20, and I think I might have overstated my understanding of that too broadly. So let me just, for the record, share my intention that what I want to be able to do is for this committee to honor the work that we did last year by not having to relitigate bills that we've heard last session, unless there are amendments and changes, substantive changes to those bills. So among them are bills that have been referred to us per Rule 4.20, which means they're coming to us from the Ways and Means Committee or from the General Register where we set those bills. Or they're bills that we voted out of our committee in the committee's omnibus bill. With that said, our intention then is to vote out those type of bills in the form that they were when we last heard them in committee, and to do so without testimony, debate, or substantive amendments. Obviously, members have the right to debate, ask for testimony, and obviously amend. My hope is that having debated those bills extensively last year, that we can minimize that and efficiently move some of these bills forward as quickly as possible. Our hope, of course, is that the other body will then also move expeditiously so that we can get to agreement on issues and bills that there should be agreement on. So with that, members, the first part of the agenda then is to look at three of those bills. And the first one is House File 571, which is my bill. And our minority lead last year referred to that as a vehicle bill. I think he was talking about transportation, but perhaps not. And so, members, I would like to then move that House File. And where are we going with this? Very well. So, members, I'm going to move House File 571 be referred to the General Register. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, like last year, this was the vehicle bill for the omnibus bill that failed. Is this your intention to have this as a vehicle bill again?
Representative Johnson, it's always good to have options before you when you're on the floor. And as you're negotiating with the Senate, and so we'll carry this bill with its important provisions for debate, and if it's a bill that can be amended to accomplish our collective goals, then it certainly will be my intent to do that.
Chair Mariani.
Johnson.
Now, last year, there were some issues with this particular bill as a vehicle bill, because there is no Senate companion that made it impossible to match up. Will there be a, do you know if there will be a Senate companion on this bill to actually work as a vehicle bill?
Senator Johnson, we would only hope that the Senate will work as hard as we are to make sure that we pass good legislation and we have the ability to do that. And so I certainly would invite the Senate to make sure that they're lining up their proposals with our proposals. Yes.
Chair Mariani, we also need to, as a committee, make sure our bills line up with theirs as well.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Any further discussion? If not, then all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Members, we also have House File 2013. That's a Representative Dean motion or bill, and I'm hoping that you'll move this.
Head over there?
No, you can do it from right here. This bill is marijuana offenses, thresholds, adjusted, and penalties provided. We have a and that puts it in the form. All right. So very well, Representative Dean, your motion is that we move House File 2013 to the General Register, no, to Ways and Means, because we have some funding fiscal issues with this, and you have an author's amendment as well.
Yes, I do, but I believe we need to move this forward first, and then I'll put on the DE.
Yes, I am forgetting my
it's okay.
my processes. I'll
move House File 2013 to the General Register.
Very well.
It's two, I'm ways, sorry, of two ways and means. It's only our second day doing things. Yeah.
So your bill is before us, so now you okay. can move your
I would like to introduce the DE2 amendment, and my understanding, Mr. Chair, is these were actually changes that we made moving through the committee, but for some reason they didn't make it into the engrossment of the larger omnibus bill. So I would just ask that this would be the language that we consider moving this bill forward.
And Representative Dean, I just want to be really clear, particularly, especially in light of my opening comments, that what this would then do is put the bill in the form in which it left this body, this committee, rather.
That's correct,
last year,
Mr. Chair.
Very well. Any questions? Chair Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean. So, my understanding is that this amendment is changing what the bill is decriminalizing. So it used to decriminalize the cannabis mixtures, and this is going to, I think this is going to limit it. It'll limit the scope to further decriminalize bud or flower cannabis while ceasing to pursue any other kind of decriminalization for processed cannabis mixtures. And I might be misunderstanding this, but why did that happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, you're correct that that's what it does. And I think we're trying to align our issues related to marijuana to be more in line with what our intent is versus going straight from a petty misdemeanor to a felony. So this, again, includes other areas and levels of substance so that there are graduated penalties associated with those possessions or sales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean. So was this, with whom did you pursue this change? I guess I'm trying to figure out who was an advocate for this DE modification? Who are the groups?
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, you're asking me to recall from 9 months ago, and off the top of my head, I can't give you that information right now.
Okay.
Chair Lesh.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean. It just seems to be a pretty big change from what I recall. So that's why I was trying to figure out. Because, you know, marijuana politics at the Capitol here, sometimes it gets so complicated that
I try to figure out, okay, who are the players? So that's why I asked. So can you tell me, I mean, is law enforcement happier with this then, or who are we appeasing in making the DE2 amendment?
Chair Lesh, again, what we're attempting to do here is to put this bill in the form in which this committee voted it out last year. The bill, assuming that it then survives, moves forward from Ways and Means onto the floor, is certainly open to amendment at any point in time. And I suspect that some of the issues that you're driving might make good substance for subsequent amendments. But the intent at this point is to put in play what we put in play last year exactly in the same way, with some occasionally some technical changes if needed, so that we're so that we're not relitigating all these bills in this session. If we were to do that, Representative Lesh, we probably would run out of time.
Mr. Chair, if I can just add, I believe that county attorneys wanted to make sure that there was real clarity on the different forms of cannabis out there, and this language got incorporated to reflect their desires relative to the difference between flower and other types of forms of cannabis.
Sure. Mr. Chair, yeah, that's all I was looking for.
Okay.
I didn't want to relitigate anything, although I do love litigating. But I never relitigate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Any further discussion? All in favor of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same side. Motion prevails. Representative Dean, quick thoughts, 2013. Go for it.
Yeah, it's this is something I think has been, Mr. Chair, something that's been worked on for quite some time. I think we all know that our laws around cannabis come down with a pretty hard strike after you have a possession beyond the current petty misdemeanor. So this will actually align our laws relative to cannabis in a similar way that we align other types of offenses relative to a level of offense.
Thank you. With that, Representative Dean renews his motion that the House File 2013 as amended be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Dean. The third bill in this category would be House File 301. And I'll move House File 301 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. This bill, again, is in the same form that this committee passed it out last year. And there will be discussion Ways and Means relative to any costs for this bill. It's a bill that amends certain burglary crimes following a trespass notice. Discussion. Sam Johnson.
Chair Mariani, we all know we do have a new member here. I would like, if the author is here, he could explain the bill so he has an understanding of what he's voting on.
Representative Johnson, the author is not here. And again, I want to remind the committee of the spirit in which we're trying to move legislation this year. I think it's absolutely appropriate that Representative Novotny have information on this bill. And I would certainly encourage Representative Stevenson, who is the author of the bill, who's occupying another committee, to connect with Representative Novotny. This will not be the last opportunity that the good representative will have to debate this bill as it goes through the legislative session. Representative Baker. Oh, I thought you had a question. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I'll just note, I think that Representative Stevenson may have strep throat is what I've heard. That may be one reason that he's not here, but if there are questions at all, I'm sure we can get any of them cleared up regarding the bill. It's pretty straightforward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, especially dealing with this bill, I think I'm going to request a roll call on the board.
A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll. Very well. The chair will move the A2 amendment. And I'm going to ask staff to help me in describing what the amendment does.
Mr. Chair and members, this is simply a technical amendment updating the effective dates that was from last session. So they say 2019. This simply changes 2019 to 2020. No substantive effect.
Makes sense, members, because obviously we're in a different year here. Discussion on the A2 amendment? All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails. Chair renews his motion to House File 301 as amended. Be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor of that motion, please say aye. Oh, I'm sorry. There is a roll call.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fawkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to note that what this bill would do is increase penalties on repeat burglars. And so just to remind folks as they're deciding how to vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mayani?
Yes.
Representative Christensen? Representative Considine?
Yes.
Representative Dean?
Yes.
Representative Edelson?
Yes.
Representative Howard?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Lesh? Representative Long?
Yes.
Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Miller?
No.
Representative Moeller?
Yes.
Representative Nash?
Nope.
Representative O'Neill? Representative O'Neill?
Absent.
Representative Pinto?
Yes.
Representative Poston? Representative Novotny?
No.
With a vote of 10 ayes and 6 noes and 1 absent, the motion prevails. Members, next up is House File. And by the way, members, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 bills from Representative Longdoor, Joachim, Marquardt, and Baker at the end here. It is my hope that we can honor the presence of all these representatives and that we can get through these bills as expeditiously as possible. A number of these, the motion will be to lay over, so we're going to have another chance to discuss these bills. The next bill, 689, we had some discussion, a good discussion in our last committee hearing, and it's also a bill that comes to us from last year's work, but obviously with some amendments, and so we are going to then deliberate over that bill. So House File, Representative Long moves that House File 689 be referred to the General Registry. And Representative Long, you have an amendment to your bill.
Yes, I have a delete all amendment and then an amendment to the delete all.
Very well. So Representative Long moves the DE1 amendment to put the House file in the form in which he wishes it to be before us. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails. And Representative Long, you then have an amendment to the amendment?
Yes, I move my A4 amendment.
Representative Long moves the A4 amendment. And Representative Long, if you can explain the amendment and, well, actually both amendments, I suppose.
Yes. So the issue we discussed a little bit on Tuesday, and there was some confusion, but criminal sexual conduct in the fifth degree can be either a gross misdemeanor or a felony. The felony version we exempted from the overall cap last year in the bill, and that can be up to the statutory max. The gross misdemeanor version we need to cover in this bill so that it has up to a 5-year probation cap. If we didn't make this change, it would be 2 years, and that was not the intent of the author, so that's why we have this correcting amendment.
Representative Long, I'm reminded that the last hearing we actually adopted the one amendment at that time. And so we're going to have to vote to reconsider that so that we're not confusing this bill, having amended it twice with two VE1 amendments. So the bill comes before us then with that amended action last year.
So I'll move to reconsider the bill as amended from with the DE1.
Yeah, I think we're actually reconsidering. Oh boy. Chair Johnson, thank you for your help. So, so the bill was not before us and corrected because we had not made it off to the public hearing. So, so the records should show that the chair did not pull this back up after having laid it over. So we could not have had any action on it as of yet. So with that, the chair then lifts the House File 689 from the table. And now it is properly officially before us on the record. And it is before us with the D1 amendment. So, Representative Long, then, now that the bill is before us, the motion is to reconsider the DE1 amendment.
That is my motion.
From 2 days ago. Representative Long so moves. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All the same sign, motion prevails. Now, we can start constructing the bill in which...
So now I will move my A4 amendment to the bill that is before us, please.
Representative Long, I believe you need to move the DE.
Thought we reconsidered it with the DE.
Okay, I'm going to ask staff to help me here now because I'm
Mr. Chair, members, at this point, the original 689 is before the committee. You've taken the amended bill off the table and you have undone the adoption of the DE amendment. There's now an amendment to Representative Long's DE amendment. You need to adopt that if the body decides to adopt that amendment, and then you'll have the DE amendment as amended before this committee, and the committee can vote on whether or not to adopt the DE as amended.
So I will move my A4 to the DE1.
Very well. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
And then I will move the DE1 as amended.
All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Long, I believe the bill is before us the way you really intended it to be before us.
It sure is.
My apologies to you, sir.
No problem. And we discussed it on Tuesday, so I won't have further comments because I know we have a tight agenda.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the sake of time, this will be brief. I just want to make a quick comment that I think the intent of this is good. I have some questions that we're going to have to clean up because in the case of when it comes to sexual offenses, I know that there's exceptions to things of that nature. But what happens in the case where someone has a most decidedly sexual assault offense that they plead down outside of law for something like that, and then this no longer applies to them, even though we probably want to keep tabs on someone that should be registered, should be something like that. And I know it's not an intended consequence of this, but it's going to be a consequence. I know that because there is a case in my district right now where someone has most decidedly a sexual offense crime that occurred, but they pled to something outside of that, if that made sense. I know it's kind of wordy, but I think you kind of know the intent of what I'm saying. Representative Long, that's a concern of mine, and if you could explain to me later how that would not happen, that would be helpful to me. Thank you.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that in terms of registry, once an individual is charged, even if they plead down, they're registered. But the underlying intent of this bill was really not to deal with that question. That was the amendment to try to make sure we weren't making things worse. But this is to try to deal with the 5 versus 6 year issue for a criminal vehicular operation.
Oh, it was specific.
So is the underlying bill, and to try to fix the anomaly that came out of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission that they weren't able to address, and I was hoping we could.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
I apologize. I misunderstood. I thought this was actually dealing with that five-year cap in general. That's what I thought we were about, so I apologize for not misunderstanding.
Not at all, Representative Miller. Representative Johnson.
Since there was a, I believe there was a fiscal note, Mr. Chair, on the original bill as a DE amendment, since there is some changes to it, had a fiscal note.
Representative Johnson, we may want to ask our fiscal staff to answer or provide some information on that. Mr. Walz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I don't believe the DE amendment would change the costs in the fiscal note.
Very well. So, Representative Long, I think we're ready to vote on your bill, but I think we need a different motion.
Yes, I'm going to move to re-refer to the General Register.
Ways and Means.
To Ways and Means, excuse me. Move to re-refer to Ways and Means.
Very well. Members, Representative Long moves House File 689 as an amendment be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Long. Representative Noor, House File 3003. Welcome to the committee, Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to bring the other testifiers and.
Representative Noor, the chair moves House File 3003 be referred to the Committee on Housing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here to present House File 3003, but I also wanted the other members, I know there are some family members and others who wanted to be with us today, if they can come and join us, those who have been impacted by this issue, including some of the firefighters who have been with us. They can come and join us here. So, Mr. Chair, this is House File 3003, which requires installation of automatic sprinkler system in existing high-rise buildings. On the day just before the Thanksgiving holiday, I received a call about a fire incident in my district. We lost five people. We lost Jerome Stewart, Nadifo Mahmoud, Mariam Mahmoud, Taylor Barron, Amatullah Adam. Mr. Chair and other four members have been injured by this tragic incident on a fire that happened on the 14th floor of Cedar Riverside apartment owned by Minneapolis Public Housing. I knew personally those individuals who died. One of the individuals who was injured was a firefighter. If we would have had this legislation 25 years ago, we would not have been sitting here talking about this bill. And we could have prevented this tragic incident. We have waited for too long to address this issue. In fact, former Governor Annie Carlson said it was a mistake not to veto the bills when he did twice during the 1990s. We owe it to the families that we've lost in Cedar Riverside. Some of the family members are here with us. It's time for us to act to ensure that everyone should have a secure and safe place to call home. I think we all agree this is something that we should have taken care of a long time ago. And nobody who is a senior, individuals with disabilities, or families with children who have to go through this process again. I have several buildings in my own district which are owned by the public housing, a nonprofit, and other private entities who are not in compliance with this bill because they were exempt when the automatic sprinkler required. So it's time for us to act and ensure that we do have fire sprinklers installed in any high-rise building, regardless whether it's a residency or it's a business. So I'm asking you to support the House file, and I would like to pass it along to Tom Bryce, who will walk us through the process.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bruce. Is it Bruce or Bryce?
Bryce, sorry. Mr. Chairman. Tom Brace, B-R-A-C-E.
Very well. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Brace. I was your Minnesota State Fire Marshal from 1987 through 2003, experienced the last go-around, if you will, where this piece of legislation was vetoed twice. It's been said that you can't go home again, but clearly the opportunity to redress this issue 25 years later is upon us, and it is definitely a life-saving opportunity that we have a second bite at the apple, so to speak. Prior to that, I was the Washington State Fire Marshal. I directed that office for 10 years, Minnesota for 16 years. And in the desire to be completely candid, I am currently a part-time employee of the National Fire Sprinkler Association. Part-time employee, but I've been a sprinkler advocate since the late 70s. The legislation before you, I think, is a very reasonable effort to address this issue. 12 years. You have 12 years to secure funds, review plans, find craft labor, and so forth, working in concert with the State Fire Marshal Division on a timetable to bring this about. You don't have to do it tomorrow. This is a significant effort. We have with us also the former fire chief of St. Paul, who can also address St. Paul's efforts in high-rise retrofit over the same time, should you care to delve into it even deeper. The bill gives then time. It has made an inclusive committee that monitors this whole process. We've tried to identify various groups that would have an interest in it. It's referred to as the working group on sub six. I think that's important as we go along. So maybe you have somebody who can't meet the deadline or has some additional problems. He or she has an opportunity to approach the state fire marshal and individually adjust a schedule. We call that extensions. There are two groups of people that are at the greatest risk from fire. Our children, 10 and under, and our seniors, 60 and over. Those two groups of people die at a disproportionate rate in fire. Add to it the high-rise component that we're trying to address today, and a magnificent fire department, and I don't mean to exaggerate, but if you have the opportunity to hear a briefing from the Minneapolis Fire Chief John Friedel, talked about a textbook response and everything amazingly difficult in terms of weather and wind and obstructions and temperature and so forth, and they still had about 14 minutes to put water. From when they first got the alarm, they had water on that fire in 14 minutes. A tremendous response, but five people died, and it could be many more. So we urge your consideration of this technology that's been with us since the turn of the last century. Sprinklers date back to before 1900. But historically, they were used to protect warehouses and manufacturing facilities. And through the years, we've learned that this technology also is life-saving, to the point we've gone, the technology has arrived in single-family residences, example, in quick response heads. What we have here is an opportunity to make both public housing, housing in general, and office buildings, that type of activity, over 75 feet would be sprinklered with your approval of this piece of legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Brace, for your testimony. Thank you for your service to our state as well for 16 years. Representative Noor.
Mr. Chair, I have the State Fire Marshal, Mr. James Smith.
Welcome, sir, to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, since 2004 here in Minnesota
alone. I'm sorry, sir. Let me interrupt. I'm sorry. I should have done this. It's our custom that we, more than our custom, is our requirement that as people testify, they state their name so that it's officially on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Smith. I am the State Fire Marshal.
Welcome, Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, since 2004, in Minnesota alone, there have been 64 fires that started on or above the seventh floor in high-rise structures. The greatest majority of high-rise fires occurred in multifamily residences. An automatic fire sprinkler system was present in each of these 64 fires. Unfortunately, there's been widespread misconception of how fire sprinkler systems work because Hollywood would have you believe an activated fire sprinkler system looks something like a deluge system in a car wash. I want to assure you nothing could be further from the truth. A sprinkler head is an independent part of the entire sprinkler system or water grid. If an individual sprinkler head is exposed to enough heat, that individual sprinkler head activates, spraying water down over a little deflector, and it extinguishes the fire. One head. If the fire grows, the next sprinkler head closest to that fire will activate as well. Rest assured that only the necessary amount of sprinkler heads will activate in order to suppress the fire. It does not look like Hollywood has given us over the past umpteen years. In the 64 high-rises or high-rise fires described earlier, a single sprinkler head extinguished the fire at each incident, a single fire or a sprinkler head. The main difference between those 64 fires and the deadly fire that occurred at 4 a.m. in a 400-square-foot apartment on the 14th floor of 630 Cedar is that there was no automatic sprinkler system that was installed to protect the individual apartments or the residents who live there. Though the specifics remain unclear on how the fire started, we do know that this tragic fire would have most assuredly been quickly contained, if not completely extinguished, had there been the presence of an automatic fire sprinkler system in the apartment building. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the State Fire Marshal Division has always and will always advocate for the installation of automatic fire sprinklers in all multifamily high-rise dwellings. And through this legislation, proposed federal assistance, and public and private partnerships, we have a path leading us forward to retrofit every single multi-story apartment building in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Fire Marshal Smith. Representative Noor, I see there's a George Sherman as well.
Yes. Is he here? He's not here yet.
All right, very well. Okay. Looks like we have some additional testifiers that wish to come forward. Mr. Kyle Berndt, I hope I pronounced that correctly, Director of Public Policy of Minnesota Multi-Housing Association.
Here.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Kyle Berndt. I'm the Director of Public Policy at the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. We were saddened by the tragedy at the Cedar High Apartments that happened last year. But earlier today, I had the opportunity to speak with Representative Neuer. We spoke about the bill that's in front of us here, and he talked to me about the separate bonding proposal that is out there for some of the current public housing. We're still evaluating the proposal that's in front of us here, but wanted to highlight naturally occurring affordable housing. We're hopeful that there's funding to be considered for this. moving forward to keep these units affordable. We are ready to be a resource for the author and members of the committee. With that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. And please, testifiers, don't wander too far because we'll open up the question and answer in a few questions, in a few minutes. Mr. Trinidad Uribe from Local 417.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Uribe.
And committee members. My name is Trinidad Uribe III. I'm the sprinkler fitter business manager for Local 417 here in Minneapolis, St. Paul. I'm just going to read my letter, which you guys have in front of you. Thank you for addressing this very serious issue of non-sprinklered high-rise buildings. This is a life safety issue for the occupants, residents, and first responders if and when a fire were to happen. This would also include the surrounding community of the impact of those of these catastrophic fires, which would impose, if not sprinklers. The statistics historically prove that fire sprinklers greatly reduce the likelihood of the spread of fire within the building, which in turn saves lives. It is quite obvious that these existing high-rise buildings without fire sprinklers lack the new technologies of the fire protection industry that newly constructed buildings have. But this bill would do just that, make these existing buildings safer. Time is of the essence right now to ensure that we will not have any more lives lost due to the lack of fire protection in these types of buildings. Sprinkler Fitters Local 417 represents those who install and maintain these life safety fire protection systems within the state of Minnesota. We save lives and protect property every single day. We believe in our craft. We believe in the fire protection industry. We believe automatic fire sprinkler systems and strongly support this legislation. Sincerely, Trinidad J. Uribe III.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Members, I'm going to open it up to question and answer.
Mr. Chair, if you will allow just a quick testimony from the family of the victims.
But of course.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee. My name is Abdi Muhammad. It was an unfortunate night on November 27th of last year. And in honor for the 630 people who died, that's Marian Mahmoud, Durham Stewart, Amatala Adam, Taylor Scott, and my mom, Alifa Mahmoud. As Representative Noor said so in his opening statements, we're here for just to have fire sprinklers retrofitted on the big rises, high rises, if not in the buildings. Again, it was an unfortunate time for all of us, my family, my daughter here with me here too. And I just want to read some stuff so that I got from the internet. And this is just in Minnesota. It says, over the years, Minnesota lawmakers have considered requiring the owners of older high-rise buildings retrofit them with sprinklers, but none of those proposals were adopted. That's unfortunate. I mean, this could not have happened. And as the president, I know I said that 20 years ago, it was supposed to be done, but nothing has happened. After one of those efforts failed, that state level, and this Zakat, that's a St. Paul fire chief marshal, public housing agency decided it wouldn't wait any longer. That's St. Paul. Again, Minneapolis did not go ahead with what St. Paul did 20 years ago. And this is unfortunate again. If I might read from NFPA, which is National Fire Protection Association, it says, properly installed and maintained automatic fire sprinkler systems help save lives. Because fire sprinklers system react so quickly, they can dramatically reduce the heat, flames, and smoke produced in a fire. Fire sprinklers have been around for more than a century. As Mr. Bryce said, and Fire Marshal James Smith said so. Fire sprinklers have been around for more than a century protecting commercial, industrial properties, and public buildings, such as hotels, hospitals, and high-rises. Again, if I may summarize a little bit here, there is no price, no number you can put on human life. thus including the people who died in the fire rise on the 11th, on 27th of last year, on November, including my beloved mom. There's no price or number to put on a human life. The safety and security fire sprinklers provide to residents are also priceless. We all know fires can happen anywhere. At any time, when a fire sprinkler is present, the likelihood of massive property damage and loss of life is dramatically reduced. So I urge you, please, Mr. Chairman and the committee, please pass this legislation. I hope none of us need to see any of this happen again. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mohammed. And I believe I speak not only for myself, but for all the committee members here, and expressing our deepest sympathy and our hearts going out to you and to all the family members who suffered loss on that day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Hassanan Mohammed. And I just want to say that this incident that happened has taken a toll in our lives for people who are connected to the victims of the fire in Cedar Riverside. This was a 25-floor building, and the fire started at 14th floor. And we still had one individual from the other top level who died. There was a considerable amount of smoke and fire that some of the victims could not even open their doors to come out of their homes because of the amount of heat and fire coming out. This is at 14th floor, and I happened to take the fire ops training with the firemen about 2-3 years ago in Fridley. So I know exactly how it feels to go into a building full of engulfed fire. I've been there. I've done the training. I've looked at it. You don't expect our firemen to carry somebody who's an elder. This floor has 8 units at each floor. And how do we expect them to just walk up, you know, with over 100 pounds of equipment and carry somebody to come down with them? This is an unfair expectation of our great firemen, who most of them are here, that I've supported them throughout the years. But this is personal to me. One of the mothers, Nadifo, which I've pushed Mahmoud, Representative Mahmoud, to name this bill after her. I grew up with our son from kindergarten all the way to high school. So it is personal to me. You know, I cannot say enough how our mothers feel, because I've been to that building every night, sitting down with them, ensuring them we're going to do something about this. I don't want us to use money in a bad way, but this saves lives. I cannot imagine losing my mother in a fire. Now my family has to do with it. So it is personal to me. And I hope you look at this with the lenses that these are elders. You don't expect them to wake up at 3 a.m. in the morning and run down the stairs from 14th floor. You can do something. It's in your hand. And I hope you realize that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mohammed, and our deep sympathies to you as well. Thank you for the courage to be here with us today. Representative Noor, are we ready for questions and answers?
We're ready for questions. I don't see.
Very well. So we have several members, beginning with Representative Edelson, then Representative Nash.
Representative Noor, I want to thank you for bringing this bill. And I want you to know that your community is in my thoughts. I'm so sorry about their loss. But it goes bigger than that. This is an issue that the rest of the state is actually impacted by in the safety of them. So this bill is really important. In Edina, the city I represent, we have a high rise in our city. Our city has been working with the owner to try to install a sprinkler system, and they have not worked with us. And so their safety is at risk. So I want you to know, from Minneapolis to Edina, I think all the way to Buffalo, all over our state, this is an issue. So I thank you for bringing this issue. And for and cost, I think the cost is too high for us to not do something. So I'm sorry for your family's loss.
Thank you, through Representative Edelson. Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the families, our deepest sympathies. I learned a lot about fire sprinkling from my wife, who is a fire safety engineer. So when she was testing for things, I was helping her get ready for that. So I learned a lot. And I just have some questions. And this isn't to say one thing or another as to how I may feel about this bill, but I just have some questions, Representative Neuer. So when you go to retrofit a building, and this may be for one of the folks from the sprinkler plumbers, when you retrofit, is that going to necessitate people leaving the apartment buildings? And what happens with that? Because I just want to know what's the expectation when that is undertaken?
Mr. Brace.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just had a briefing on that on Tuesday at a high-rise summit, and we had reports that the individual occupancy could be retrofitted in a day. Remember that the on high-rise buildings, that what we call standpipes, go up to the top of the building, and you tap into that, if you will, run the line down the hallway and then into the respective units. So we're hearing a minimal disruption. Now, remember, it's on the outside. I mean, this is no attempt to hide the sprinkler heads with coves and so forth. I mean, you got a pipe going through, and it's a little bit of training not to hang anything from the pipe. But it is not as disruptive as you might think. And that testimony came not from the industry, it came from a presenter from the St. Paul Public Housing, that some days he could do two in a day. Once they got rolling. So relatively minimal disruption would be the response.
Mr. Uribe.
Yes, I'll continue on with that. As a fitter for over 20 years and being out and installing these retrofit buildings, particularly in St. Paul, it is really a real less intrusive type of installation. Usually have a crew of 2 to 3 that are piggybacking on these particular units. But we were usually in and out of a unit anywhere from a half a day to a day. So, yes, it's very less intrusive to do this type of fitting in the residence itself.
Representative Nash.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Second question, and this is, again, not to say one way or another, but there's going to be a cost to this. How does that work? And if I understand it correctly, the expectation is, if this were to become law, the reason that you set it out such a long way is that you're going to, I guess, expect the business owners or the building owners to begin accruing over time the cost to retrofit the building. And that is it also an expectation that it may impact rents? Is that something that is being talked about, thought about, and is that something that is out in the open? Because I think that if we're going to have a conversation about this, we should talk about the full impact of what might happen if this became law.
Representative Neuer, the motion is to send this to Housing Committee, where I would fully expect that a deeper dive into those appropriate questions would be good, but please, very quickly.
Number one is that the issue of cost should never have hindered the installation. We know that the cost of installing, it's cheap. In fact, they will save money when it comes to insurance. And that's the first thing. We have some resources that we're going to allocate through the capital investment to make sure that public housing have got enough resources. In fact, we're also in communication with our partners at the local level, including the federal government, whereby there is an existing law that gives tax incentives to businesses who own high-rise buildings that are not occupied by people to extend it to residency. That's another piece we're looking into. At this moment, the public housing is our priority based on the need that we have seen.
And
thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Neuer, if you would you mind getting that to me and maybe other members would be? I'd like to see that. Again, I think it's not an unreasonable question to ask to have that provided for us. And I understand I don't serve on housing, but if I'm going to have to vote for this one day or another, I would like to see that information because I think it's germane to what the final outcome of this is. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think it's an appropriate request. Representative Lucetto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just start off by saying our hearts and sympathy definitely go out to the friends, family, and loved ones of those who unfortunately lost their lives in the tragedy last year. And I do have several questions for the bill author or anybody else who can answer. On line 1.8 through 110, it defines the buildings that will be in scope, which includes at least one story used for human occupancy is 75 feet or more above the lowest level of fire department vehicle access. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Nora, could you tell me approximately how many floors of a building does that 75 feet requirement translate to?
I believe it's six. Mr. Chair, I believe it's seven floors, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So approximately seven floors. So the next question is, approximately how many buildings do you estimate in Minnesota meet this criteria and will then be in scope if this bill were to become law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, as far as I know, we don't have the exact numbers, but what I know of Minneapolis public housing, out of 46 high-rise buildings, 16, I believe, have sprinklers. So the rest, we need to make sure that we install them to protect lives and actually protect the properties that we have.
Okay, is there anybody, Mr. Chair, anybody else who might be able to answer approximately how many buildings have seven or more floors that would meet this criteria? I'm just trying to get a scope here of what we're going to be impacting across Minnesota.
Nora, I suspect that no one does in this room. However, that is information that can come forward. Similarly to the information that Representative Nash asked for at another issue, and again, this bill, if it's successful here, will be heard in Housing Committee, where I suspect they'll be doing some very deep dives in your appropriate questions, Mr. Lucero.
Okay,
thank
you, Mr. Chair. So, yes, if that could be looked into, definitely I'm interested. Next question is, what year, Mr. Chair and Representative Knorr, what year did new construction buildings begin to require fire suppression systems?
Senator Knorr?
1970. Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, I believe it's 1974, so anything that was built after 1974.
Senator Lucero?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then so 1974, or earlier than 1974, then obviously we won't have the fire suppression systems. So, Mr. Chair, the next question would be, do we know an approximate cost per square foot that it will cost to retrofit these buildings of seven or more floors built prior to 1974 across Minnesota?
Representative Lucero, I'm going to allow this continued line of questioning. I don't think it's inappropriate. However, as I indicated at the beginning of this committee meeting, we have a number of bills up, bills from Representative Joaquim, Representative Marquardt, and Representative Baker, all bills that I think we can find lots of common ground on. And I would like us to be able to hear those bills and honor the people who come here to be able to testify on that. I am certainly prepared to be here for a long period of time and keep this committee here to answer all your questions. But I really would ask, for efficiency and focus in terms of our line of questioning. I don't think it's inappropriate. Again, I will remind members this bill is, if it's successful here, and at the Housing Committee, where a number of these questions, I think, are much more on point relative to a Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform. But Representative Lucero, you have
so, with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the indulgence. And it is not my intent to delay on. These are, as you indicated, genuine, real questions. So, with that, I'll just put that on the record. So, if the bill author could look into that as this continues forward, that would be excellent. So, then the last question I would have, just for the record, which could be answered in the future, would be, I see some of the exceptions in some Division 2, one of them being, for example, a building used for agricultural purposes. I'm curious to know what are some examples of buildings that are 75 feet or more that have at least one floor used for human occupancy that are also agricultural purposes that will be excluded
And my similar question then for meeting that criteria, that there's a need for an exception for electrical generation distribution facilities, same thing for some of these other exceptions. So just curious with that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to add to the families how sorry I am for your loss. Given the number of questions, I just will make a statement, which is I think 12 years is exceedingly too long. And I'd like to see if we get that process sped up a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Considine. Representative Polston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nash asked most of my questions. I just have one quick one, and this is for the fire experts up there. We're talking about sprinkler systems and some of the retrofitting and the disruption that that may cause. Are there other kinds of suppression, fire suppression, that can be used alternative to sprinklers?
Mr. Chair, Representative, fire sprinklers are the ultimate highest level of fire safety protection there is. You will hear people argue about compartmentation, and some of these public housing structures are built like vaults or strong multi-inch thick walls. The problem is not necessarily what it's built out of. It's what is inside it. All of the interior furnishings and flammable furniture and cooking and unattended cooking, which is the leading cause of fire in Minnesota and many parts of the country. So there is, to my knowledge, no alternative with the track record that you heard testified about fire sprinklers.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Representative Beal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a really simple kind of clarification question for the author. On line 1.21, one of the exemptions is a residential building where 70% of the occupants is owner occupied, so the owner owns it and occupies it. And, you know, I'm kind of thinking this bill through and thinking how important it is and for safety of everyone that's in that building, and just wondering what was your thought behind excluding owner occupied.
If I might, Mr. Chair, Representative
O'Neill,
said not to offend, but as a matter of fact, condominium owners can be a very intransient group, and in terms of voting for their mechanism is they vote for all expenses to go through a condominium association, and anything that costs money historically has a very difficult time of going through some of these condominium associations. So there was an attempt to recognize that we would compromise, and I know that may be an unattainable word for some, but if you have 70 or more percent owner-occupied, then you could be excluded. We would hope that through public education we could educate some of these homeowners associations and try to sell the value of sprinklers to them, but they have been in historically a somewhat intransient group, and we tried to recognize that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so they don't want to pay for it, I guess is what you're saying. Okay, thank you.
I can't be any more clear than that.
Chairman Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I've been sitting here listening, and I've had to, you know, in designing tall buildings over a while, I mean, remember, the building code changed, I believe, in 1979. So that's all buildings that were proposed after that, although the state of Minnesota is a little bit slow in adopting changes to building codes, and it goes through an approval process. So it would have probably been the mid-80s that this would have actually been, in fact, for all the buildings that by definition were considered high-rises for them all to be sprinkled. So as we talk about these numbers, some of you may be thinking we have hundreds of thousands of buildings out there. We don't. We might have hundreds of buildings out there at the most. And regarding the condominiums, I don't know if we have any condominium buildings that would fall under this that are higher than 75 feet that would have been built after the mid-80s. I mean, the condominium boom in Minnesota really began like in the 90s, where we have those, and all of those buildings have sprinklers in them. So I think when we think about the cost of this and all those other issues, I commend the author for giving those individuals that are private building owners till 2032 to give them a reasonable time to work out the performas to change their costs so that the burden isn't, you know, immediately laid on the residents of those buildings, so that a rent on a unit might go up $150 a month to cost that retrofit. You know, over time, building owner can recover those costs. So I think this is really, really an important bill, and there will be a bill going through capital investment that will actually help fund those public housing projects that will be burdened with making these changes. But it's a change that needs to happen, and you know, as Governor Carlson said, he wishes it was something he would have done back then. But when it comes to buildings and the actual buildings of buildings, there's often a lot of resistance of driving up costs. We've had talk about sprinklers in residential houses throughout the state of Minnesota. And, of course, it will add costs to a particular housing, which then has a huge impact. We can talk about affordable and all those other things. So, again, thank you, Representative Noor, for bringing this forward. And for those families who lost loved ones or friends, this is something we probably should have done a while ago. And I think the saying goes, this would be a terrible tragedy to waste and not do something to change this moving forward. So thank you again.
Agreed, Representative Dean. And Representative Noor, you've heard a lot of good questions, which I would hope you'll be prepared when you go, assuming the bill goes to housing. But you do some real deep dives on some of these housing questions. To close this out, folks, we do have Mr. George Sherman here. I'm going to ask him to come forward for some quick thoughts, and then we'll move to a vote. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Hello, Chairman and Board. I'm George Sherman, Sherman Associates. We are a multifamily housing developer and owner throughout the state of Minnesota. I think we have housing in almost every segment of the state. One of the reasons I'm talking here today is we are the owners of those multicolored panel buildings right next to the public housing project that was the source of the tragedy. As a private owner, we undertook the installation of the fire sprinkler system in those 1,300 units. I think it's the largest concentration of housing in any one block in the state of Minnesota. We undertook those improvements in 2010 and 2011. And as a private owner, I'm going to tell you this is the right bill to pass, and you should do it. It's the time to make it happen. It isn't the buildings that burn, it's what's inside the building in the units that burn in these high rises. At the same time, I will tell you, you should do the study of how many units are impacted. I think you're going to see that a lot of them are sources of affordable housing because they were built pre-1979, and they are often a source of affordable housing throughout the state. So it's not just public housing, but this will fall upon some of the affordable housing owners, a lot of them nonprofits, a lot of them private owners who provide affordable housing. And that could be a source of, that will be a challenge for some of these affordable housing units to pay almost any kind of increase. I think that in cost, and I think that is why having the right amount of time to do the improvements is absolutely necessary. I think the state should also look at the possibility of how these nonprofits, we're for-profit, but how nonprofits or other owners of affordable housing can maybe help absorb some of the cost of this fire sprinkler system. Because many of these are rent-controlled many of them, you do not want to push the owner into thinking about going market rate. You want to save the housing for both the safety of the people. You want to do the sprinklers because it's the right thing to do, but you don't want to force these buildings into having to look at alternatives as such as going market rate or not being able to afford it and getting into other kinds of deferred maintenance. So as a private, I would also tell you that it is not that disruptive. We tore out the plumbing, the mechanical systems, everything in these buildings. Like people live there. The sprinkler system was the least problematic problem. But it is not absolutely a slam dunk. Many of these buildings built before 1979 have very low levels of asbestos in the walls. And nothing that would create an environmental issue or concern for people. But if you go put a new pipe through the wall, you're going to disturb some of the asbestos that was in that wall. So I wouldn't tell people that this is a slam dunk installation process and you can do it over. It has to be done thoughtfully. But the loss of life is not worth the postponing this longer. It's time to do it. Other buildings are vulnerable, and as a private owner, I would tell you to do it. But try and understand that a lot of these are affordable housing. You may have an impact on the ability of those private nonprofits, private owners to keep it affordable. And it is very viable for owners to do it, but it is not a slam dunk as far as its feasibility. If the state or part of your process can even help owners figure out how to get through the process of doing fire sprinklers without disrupting people, I think that would also be a very positive comment. So we're glad we put in the sprinkler. Otherwise, we could have done the Facebook picture. I don't want to do that. And I certainly think it's time for this bill to get passed. And I think you'll find private owners wanting to be part of the solution, but cognizant that this is not without some consequences financially. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony and your advice. And Representative Nash promised me it would be a very brief question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, since you undertook this effort to retrofit 1,300 units, could you maybe give us an idea of what the approximate cost was and what that did to the rents?
The cost of it for us was about $2,500 per unit. So 1,300 units times any number is big. In that case, it was about $4 million. But $2,500 was the cost. We chose not to have exposed pipes running through all the unit. It is not necessarily attractive or safe to have exposed pipes of people hanging things on. So we did sheetrock around the pipes to make it look somewhat attractive. We tried to design it so it looked like as much as possible that it was thought out and respectful of the residents that people were living in. We were able to use a variety of tools, including we had the ability to borrow money from the finance institutions and the fact that interest rates were low. So we were part of $3 million when we were doing a $70 million renovation, so $3 million was 5%. We figured out a way to fit that into the budget. But if you don't have another source to do it, $2,500 a unit can be an expensive number. But we did choose to sheetrock it. We did have to do some asbestos abatement. You can do it for less. I tell you that the $2,500 is well worth the cost of doing it. You also do save on insurance, and insurance companies will give you a discount for having a fire sprinkler building, even if it's concrete. And that fire, that can be very well on the order of 10 to, between 5 and 15% of your annual insurance on your bill. So there are savings to it. There's moral savings. There's financial savings to it. But it is not an absolute neutral to the owner's annual budget. It will have some cost increase. Having time to do it is absolutely appropriate consideration. But I think not doing it is also not the right thing.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash, yeah. I thought it was going to be a brief one.
I did have a second part of the question as to how it related to impact on rents. I was kind of hoping to hear that.
Well, Thank you. Representative Lucero, you also promised me a very...
I'll make it super quick by not asking the question. I'll just make a comment. Heard the testifier correctly, it was roughly 2007, I think, is when it retrofitted?
2011.
So, Mr. Chair, I'll just add to the committee's understanding as well, that that would have been prior to the lead law enforcement. And so you had mentioned 1979, which actually sparked a recollection here. We now have lead law when it comes to retrofitting existing construction. And so the cost, the $2,500 number we just heard, generally is going to be about 10% higher now due to the lead law that we have to, as general contractors, take into consideration. So it is something to take into consideration. All of these buildings will then have to go through the lead testing, et cetera, to have even higher costs. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the observation. Members, again, these are excellent Housing Committee questions. We are the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee, and I'd like us to hew close to that. Representative Nash, you did have a question. You didn't get an answer, I believe. So you wanted...
Mr. Chair, I had asked part of the question of what did that do for the impact of rent, and if you could tell us how you recovered the $3.25 million that you put out.
Very briefly, Mr. Sherman.
In our particular case, I cannot tell you that we raised rents at all because of it. We raised rents because we were doing other improvements, but our rents at the project have not materially gone up above CPI or inflation. So we were able to absorb this. I can tell you the capital cost, because we were fortunate that interest rates have dropped so low that we were borrowing free money. It did not increase our rents at all to do it, and we did save on interest. I think if we would do the we are committed, regardless what this state does as law, to make sure that all of our buildings have fire sprinklers in them.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. Representative Johnson, you get the last word here.
I'll be very
last question anyway.
Very brief, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
I appreciate what Representative Knorr's bill is trying to do. The concern I have is for Greater Minnesota. We do have a few buildings like this that would qualify that are not in town or in a city with zero water, static water. It means they have their own well. They're not on a city water supply system with static water pressure. With something like this, it would require a lot more expense because they'd have to put in either 6 or a 12-inch well to run the system that hopefully it'll never be used, and it could be quite expensive even if they could get the permit. In some areas, it's very tough to even get a permit to put a well in. So that's something to consider when dealing with this. Like I say, under static water pressure, I understand it. It's a good idea. But if you don't have static water pressure, you also need uninterruptible power, which runs power lines where the firefighters going to fight the fire might be in danger because they don't know where those are.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Knorr, you get the last word as we get ready to...
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, I think most of the buildings, as far as I'm aware of, if they're a high-rise building, they already have the pipes installed and ready to go with, the fire extinguishers. So basically, they already have a system that is already working, and we're hoping to tap into those pipes and to be able to provide the sprinklers in there. Mr. Chair, my final word is sprinklers save lives. It protects property and also reduces injuries. So it's time for us to act, and I would like to ask you to support this bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. And with that, the chair renews his motion that House File 3003 be referred to the Committee on Housing. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Knorr. Thank you to all the testifiers. Members, we have three bills left, and we have a few people who I suspect have traveled a bit of a distance from rural communities in our state, and so I want us to... So I want to make sure that we honor the fact that they've traveled great distances to be here so they can then get back home safely before the sun sets here in Minnesota. So next up is House File 1782, Representative Joaquin. Representative Joaquin, welcome to the committee. The chair moves House File 1782, and we're going to be... I see we're going to be laying this over, but the motion is to re-refer to the Committee on Ways and Means. And Representative Joaquim, so the bill is before us. You have an amendment, author's amendment, the A1 amendment. If you'd like, I can move that for you at this point.
That would be fine, sir.
Very well. The chair moves the A1 amendment. Welcome to the committee, Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you want me to start the testimony and we could get to the amendments,
Chair,
or did you want to do the amendments first?
Chair Mariani. Representative, hold on a second. Representative Joaquim, Representative Johnson.
The A1, I believe, is out of order.
The A1's mine.
This provides, actually puts spending in the next biennium, and I don't believe that this legislature can require the next biennium's legislature what they have to spend money on.
Representative Johnson, the chair will lay over the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Joaquim, House File 1782.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry we have testifiers that are survivors that need to get home and pick up kids from work. So. From daycare. So good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for hearing House File 1782, a bill that would create the Hometown Heroes Assistance Program. For some quick background, the MnFIRE Initiative is a 24-hour call hotline center that was started 3 years ago with funds from a grant and a lot of different fundraisers. Within the first 24 hours of the hotline being open, it became apparent that there was a dire need in our firefighting community. Firefighters face cancer, cardiac issues, and mental health challenges at higher rates than the rest of our population just for doing their jobs. Jobs that we ask them to do and jobs that many of us would not be willing or able to do. They perform these jobs without hesitation, and we really need to have their backs. The Hometown Heroes Program is one of the ways we can do that. I have with me George Espenson from the Minnesota Fire Initiative, who is a retired fire chief from Eden Prairie. He will quickly go over the bill. We also have a few testifiers who will share their stories on what the program like this would have meant to them had it been in place. These folks are Steve Shapira, a retired St. Paul captain and cancer survivor, two surviving spouses of firefighters, Angie Hopkins and Emily Vollmer, and Chris Parsons from the president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters and the captain of the St. Paul Fire Department. I know the committee's time is tight and precious, so each of them will only take a few minutes to hear to tell their stories, but it's really their voices that you need to hear. So first, I'll turn it over to George.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Espenson. It's good to see you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is George Espenson. I'm with the Minnesota Firefighter Initiative. Our mission began as a support organization and resource center for the three major killers of active firefighters: cancer, emotional trauma, and cardiac issues. We have trained nearly 100 peer supporters who take calls and provide resources to firefighters and their loved ones who call because they themselves or their firefighter loved one is being deeply impacted by the job. Research shows that firefighters are twice as likely to be stricken by cancer and cardiac issues and 2 to 6 times more likely to die by suicide than the general population. The Hometown Heroes Assistance Program bill will provide support to those already impacted, provide education, prevention, and mitigation strategies to all firefighters statewide to begin to reduce new instances of impacts and provide a training curriculum to medical and mental health professionals so they can more effectively deal with their firefighter clients. Specifically, the bill will provide a critical care policy to all firefighters statewide worth up to $30,000 per incidence of cardiac or cancer diagnosis, provide access to the MnFIRE Assistance Program to provide 5 in-person or telemedicine mental health support sessions, provide additional funding for firefighters needing more than that initial 5 sessions, provide 2-hour MnFIRE awareness training to every firefighter statewide on an annual basis, and provide training materials and workshops for medical and mental health providers on the unique issues facing firefighters. I would like to now take this moment to introduce our 3 testifiers, each of whom will share a brief story of their journey with these 3 firefighter deep impacts. First of all, and to my right, is retired St. Paul Fire Captain Steve Shapira, who nearly lost his life to firefighter cancer. Next up will be Angie Hopkins. There you are, Angie, sorry. Wife of Oakdale firefighter Tim Hopkins, who died from suicide. And last is Emily Vollmer, wife of Mayor Fire Department Captain Jeffrey Vollmer, who died from a cardiac arrest after a department training exercise. These three stories represent the statewide tragedies taking place among the ranks of firefighters in every city and every town in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Captain Shapira.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Steve Shapira. I'm a retired 17-year captain from the St. Paul Fire Department. My story started in the summer of 2013, which was what I thought was routine stomach pain. It took about 12 visits to a doctor and one referral, and I sat down at the University of Minnesota in the spring of 2014. The nurse came in and she took my vital signs. The internist walked in and he pulled up my CT that I had done a couple months previously, and he said, click, 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 you have lymphoma. Three clicks in 5 seconds, and I knew everything in my life was going to change. I knew my job was on the line, my finances were on the line, relationship with my wife, my kids, my whole world was going to be affected by this. That was a Wednesday morning. The doctor looked at me and looked at his schedule and said, I've got an opening on Friday morning. You want to come in and have an operation because I need to confirm this diagnosis via biopsy. I told him I needed a couple weeks to kind of get my affairs in order, and I came back 2 weeks to the, 2 weeks later to the date. And they opened me up and they did a biopsy. And they did a double-blind study, which means I sent off my tissue to two different labs, and the diagnosis came back the same. And they sent out six samples, and two of them were non-reactive, two of them were suspicious, and two of them were reactive positive for non-Hodgkin's B-cell follicular lymphoma. It's called follicular lymphoma because it looks like a hair follicle under the microscope. So the good thing about getting a follicular lymphoma is that it's slow growing. And during that time where I was undiagnosed for 9 months or so, it probably didn't change, and I was staged at a stage about 1 to 2, somewhere in there. The bad thing about a follicular lymphoma is it's stubborn or it's sticky. As my oncologist says, you have an autoimmune disease that manifests itself in cancer, and the likelihood of being cured is about a 5 to 10% rate, depending on whose numbers you use. For those who don't know, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is a blood-based cancer similar to a leukemia, so you can't radiate it, you can't cut it out. The only form of treatment is chemotherapy. And chemotherapy, if you don't know or haven't had anyone affected by chemotherapy, chemotherapy is a controlled poisoning based on your body weight. So I was, shortly after I recovered after my operation, about 3 weeks later, I started 8 aggressive rounds of chemotherapy on 3-week intervals, followed by a short break and another 12 sessions of chemotherapy every other month for a total of 20 sessions of chemotherapy over a course of about 2.5, almost 3 years. At that point, I was declared cancer-free, which obviously was a blessing. But to tell you what this did to myself and my family, it was indescribable. Not only was I physically beat down, it was mentally the toughest thing I've ever done in my life. How do you explain to your 11-year-old daughter when she asks, Dad, are you going to die? What do you say to that? How do you replace that loss of innocence? You can't. And at that point, it was just survival. I wasn't worried about my career. I wasn't worried about anything else. I went into deep debt as a result of all the medical procedures, and I ended up having to have a battle to get my workers' compensation. It's affected everything that our family has done since. I was forced to retire due to the fact that I ran out of my benefits, and I'm no longer on St. Paul Fire. As I stated, the mental issues of this are extreme. I was pulled out of the fire station where I was a leader, a captain, a leader of a crew, gone into isolation to be poisoned. It was the hardest thing I've gone through. We didn't have any training. We didn't have the hotline that's been created by MinFire. We knew nothing about firefighter occupational cancer. I hadn't heard that term until I got firefighter occupational cancer. So what MinFire has done and what they are doing is imperative to this state. I can't stress enough the importance of this bill to move forward. This is not only personal to me, this is personal to the fire service, and this needs to move forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Captain Shapira, and thank you for your service to the people of Minnesota, and particularly to the people of my beloved city of St. Paul. Ms. Hopkins?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Welcome. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Angie Hopkins. My husband, Tim Hopkins, was a firefighter for 20 years before he died by suicide in 2006. His absence was not only felt by his 5 children, his family, his friends, but by his community. Tim loved public service, but he didn't know, or he didn't have the tools needed to manage the trauma he responded to. He thought he was always doing fine, and as a proud man, he could push through the worst of his feelings. I was usually his debriefer. He came home and would tell me about his bad incidences or things he had seen. I remember him trying hard to forget when he found the burned body of a teenager that took his life in his girlfriend's garage. He thought he was just responding to a garage fire, but came across the burned body. He never could go to a cookout again without post-traumatic stress hitting him if somebody burned something at that cookout. He responded to a multiple car accident in which a father died, and he rescued a young child that looked just like one of our sons. Every time he looked at our son, he had issues and kind of had unpleasant memories of that accident. It replayed in his brain for months. We talked about it, but talking to your spouse is always not enough. So we did try to get help. These incidents and hundreds of others started to bubble to the surface. We sought help here in Twin Cities, and he was given pills, but he was never given counseling or the proper treatment to help him through what he was coping with. We also encountered stress due to many aspects of his treatment not being covered by insurance. Eventually, all these factors led to him ending his life. I know there are Minnesota firefighters at risk today, and they don't have the time to wait for another year for this bill to become law. I don't want another family to go through what my family has gone through. If this bill and assistance were around 13 years ago, my husband may have had a better chance at coping with the trauma he faced. Thank you for your time to look at this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Hopkins, and we acknowledge and are appreciative of your dear husband's service, and we hope that as we engage with you and others, that we can create better ways, just ways to support our firefighters in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Vollmer.
Thank you. My name's Emily Vollmer. My husband, Jeff, was on the Mayor Fire Department for 12 years, serving as a captain at the time of his death. It was a regular Monday night, just like any other. He'd gone to work and then gone to training with his department, and it was strenuous training. They were practicing lifts and carries up and down stairs using each other, and some of the members of fire departments are rather muscular or big. They're heavy. That's why they practice. Jeff believed in being ready and being prepared. He sought out ways to train. He looked forward to helping his department be prepared as possible. He went through all of the required testing, his EKGs, his physicals for the fire department. He saw his regular primary doctor. Tests had been done for your routine things, and he was healthy as far as anybody knew. There were no signs. There was not your typical shoulder pain. There was nothing to indicate there was a problem. He went to bed after he had come home from training the same as normal, and I found him down on the floor. And as a nurse, I knew he was already gone when I found him. But I needed help, so who did I call? The fire department. And that meant calling his friends, who had just seen him, to our home to enter a very chaotic and tragic moment of our lives. I expected them to be able to help where I couldn't do it. And I expected them to be trained and ready. This bill would give resources for all of those things, for picking up on subtle signs that might go unnoticed because they are better informed, for letting doctors know what else they should be checking for or screening for when they serve a client or patient that does serve on the fire department. I can also speak to trauma, as Jeff did go on a call, that he had to recover the body of a young child, only in single digits. He didn't talk to me other than it happened, but did tell me years later that it affected him more than he thought. As a nurse, I work in oncology. I can also speak to the effects and the difficulties that families have covering the costs of the impact of their diagnosis and the financial requirements. When firefighters show up on a scene, they bring more than just their physical strength and determination and their equipment. They bring hope to each call they go on, and that is what they offer anybody in need who is somebody to them when they look them in the eye and say, "I've got you. I'm here." And when we can find ways to support them, to bring this bill the money that it requires, we are really investing in ourselves, because at any moment in time, any one of us may find ourselves in that most horrific moment where we need to know that the people that we are calling are prepared, not only physically, but mentally as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vollmer. We are also humbled and honored by your presence and by the service of your husband. And we do hope, I'm sure all of us, that as we learn more, that we can do far better in supporting our firefighters in the state of Minnesota. With that, Representative Joachim, time is unfortunately pressing on us. Do you have another witness? Is that
correct? Just one more minute.
Come on forward, Mr. Parsons. Good to see you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make sure I'm brief. My name is Chris Parsons. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. We are an association representing over 1,800 career firefighters, paramedics, and emergency dispatchers located in over 40 communities all across Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Joachim for bringing this bill forward. I want to thank Emily Vollmer, Angie Hopkins, and Captain Shapira for being here today. It takes a lot of courage to share your stories on behalf of firefighters everywhere. I want to say thank you. And I also want to say this is probably the most important bill that I've ever had the privilege in my 7 years of coming here and testifying in front of the legislature. I'm here in strong support of House File 1782, the Hometown Heroes Assistance Program, and I will tell you that for the brave men and women who protect our communities, these heartbreaking stories are sadly way too common. This bill is a down payment on a future where we will have fewer firefighters sickened, fewer grieving spouses, and fewer firefighters wondering how they will help provide for their families if they get occupational cancer or debilitating trauma from the job. These challenges are not new. They are as old as the fire service itself, but we cannot wait on a remedy any longer, nor should we. In the last few years, a handful of other states from New York to Alabama already have provided cancer coverage to firefighters and are investing in prevention programs. Nebraska and South Carolina currently have legislation moving through their capitals as we speak. Mr. Esbenson spoke about the staggering statistics regarding firefighter cancer, cardiac rates, and suicide rates. These numbers are backed up by an ever-increasing body of evidence and prove that we cannot afford to wait any longer for meaningful action. I implore you to pass HF, House File 1782, the Hometown Heroes Assistance Program. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Parsons. Representative Joachim.
As you can tell from these very personal stories, there's an epidemic in our firefighters community, one that our cities and towns and townships can't handle alone. And as a state, I believe we are morally obligated to have our firefighters' backs. So I don't know how the chair wants to proceed. There also is an amendment to put a dollar amount, but I know you're going to be laying this over and you have another bill to be heard, so I will defer to the chair.
Representative Joachim, I actually did want to have that conversation, even though we're going to lay this over, but I think the clock is working against us. From our conversations, I know that there are two or three possible ways which we can cover this, but I don't think we're going to have enough time to do that conversation justice today. So. You have my word that this bill will be back up. It's far too important, and for it not to be up, and we'll then get into the possible financing.
Sounds good. At that point.
We do have a question for Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, it's not a question. Representative Joachim, as you know, Emily Vollmer is my friend. All of you voted to rename a highway after her husband in my district. And Representative Joachim, you've got my pledge to work on this with you, so let's get this right.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Joachim. I too have a firefighter, part of a highway named after him, who was killed in a training accident, Chip Imker. I understand the need to have myself as a firefighter. One thing I'm having problems with, there's three or four different funding sources that you have in this list. And all of it comes off the taxpayers' dollars. One of the ideas was a percentage of the tax on the insurance rates, increasing insurance rates. One was $2 increase in their insurance rates to pay for this. And this organization is a 501c3. I guess I'd like to find out how the fundraising is by the 501c3 before we start taking tax dollars to fund the program where they can actually fundraise. How many dollars do they need to raise?
Representative Joachim, Representative Johnson, as I indicated earlier, we're going to have a healthy conversation on financing for this. Representative Joachim, if you want to do a very quick few seconds, but I really do not want us to get into the conversation. We have individuals from Greater Minnesota on the next two bills that travel a great distance. We need to be out of here in about 20 minutes. I want to be able to honor the presence of those people and make sure they get home safely in time before the sun goes down today. Representative Joachim.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. The bill that you see before you is about a $7.2 million price tag, but I've been working with the advocates to find ways that we can scale it back so we could start something this year. That is why my wish is to try to take it from the general fund if we have a supplemental budget coming up, if we have a supplemental budget or surplus, or if there's any money for this year. Because as you can see from these stories, we can't wait any longer, and I do believe it's a moral obligation for us to take care of these firefighters. And that goes way beyond any kind of bake sale or fundraiser you could have.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. For the critical illness and monetary support, just 2.18 to 2.20, I was just curious. You mentioned, and by the way, I'm very supportive of this. I just want some clarification. So it says cancer and heart disease, but I'm wondering why you didn't include PTSD in this also area, because as we know, that can be debilitating. That can lead to, as one of the testifiers said, her husband committed suicide from that. So I just would like to know that piece, why that was left out of that area.
I am glad you brought that. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson. I'm glad you brought that up. There is a different section in the bill that Mr. Espenson can talk to about counseling.
Mr. Espenson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, so the strategy here is around providing a critical care insurance policy, and currently those aren't available for the PTSD diagnosis. But what we do have built in is treatment. So many times the PTSD is not debilitating to the point where people are missing long amounts of time over the longer course of time, like a cancer kind of treatment. With 3 to 5 treatments, many firefighters are able to go right back to work. And so that's why bullet point number 2 is providing those annual sort of check-ins so that we can catch things at the early stages.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative
Representative Edelson, just to further that along, if you want to look in the bill between 2.1 and 2.9, kind of goes a little bit more into detail of the framework for that trauma and mental health contact points, and then also training for ways to teach firefighters how to stay healthy that way as well.
And then also you had a few testifiers that said they had pieces or they had things that were not insured. I'm wondering if you can have them come and talk to me. I'm curious as to what they are after this committee hearing.
Great.
Thank you.
Representative Yoakley, thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's vitally important. My appreciation to Mr. Espenson, Captain Shapira, Ms. Hopkins, Ms. Palmer, and Mr. Parsons. Thank you for your hard work on this. It's been actually a while since you all have been working and trying to shape up something that can truly be supportive of our state's firefighters. Thank you for your work. With that, the chair will lay over House File 1782. House Files 1273 is Representative Marquardt. And members, there's one other bill after that, and that's Representative Baker's bill. Representative Baker, as someone who's from the Southwest Initiative Foundation, I've made that drive. That's a long drive, and so my hope is we can at least have that individual say a few words. Not pressing you, Representative Marquardt, as much as I'm pressing my own committee members. But with that, the chair moves House File 1273 be re-referred to the committee of Ways and Means. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for your cognizance of coming from rural Minnesota. I know I've been here before, and you've also mentioned that, so I really, truly appreciate that. I do have an amendment, an A1 amendment, that would just move dates from 2020 to 2021, if I could have the members move that, please.
Very well. Representative Johnson?
Chair Mariani, I'd like to move the A1 amendment. Good program, and I hope all members vote for it.
Very well. All in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Chair Marquardt, your bill as amended is before us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. What this bill would do would provide $3 million in grants to the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division that then would go out equally to the 87 counties, 11 federally recognized tribes, and 4 cities of the first class. And those dollars could be used for emergency preparedness. It could be used for planning. It could be used for capital expenses. And so why is this important? Minnesota Statute Chapter 12.25 says that every county has to have an emergency management division with at least one director. And that's a requirement for every single county. And what these emergency managers and their departments do is they will prepare, they will plan for potential disasters, and then also work at coping with disasters once they happen. And this could be, you know, a lot of times we think of non-man-made ones like tornadoes or floods, or it could be a man-made disaster, or even in this case, some sort of, or in a potential case, an outbreak of a disease. You know, you're seeing the coronavirus right now in China and some of it hitting the United States. If there was something like this in a county, it would be our emergency managers and their departments on the front lines dealing with this. And so this is very important. The only source of funding right now for kind of this emergency thing out there is the federal government, which is somewhat insecure, and then property taxes. And we know that counties don't all have the same property tax base and the same wherewithal to fund these, and yet we are relying on these folks to deal with our disasters. And I have here an honor to have Gary Johansson, who is from Norman County, the district I represent, but also the president of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers. And just in the small county of Norman, I know Mr. Johansson has had to deal with a flood and then a tornado all within a couple months span. So it doesn't matter the size of your community, but a lot of the smaller communities are more strapped for cash. So I'm going to turn it over to him at this point and let him do the work. He's the only testifier. I think he's going to name about 3 other people who would have testified that are in support, but this is the one testifier.
Very well. Thank you. Good to see you, Mr. Johansson. Yes. We have about 5 minutes for this bill. My apologies, but I do want to get the other bill in.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Gary Johansson, AMM president. AMM is Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers and Norman County Emergency Management. Greetings from Northwest Minnesota, frigid Northwest Minnesota. As am AMM president, I can tell you that AMM fully supports this bill. We have 450 members, and then the 87 counties, 11 tribal nations, 4 cities of the first class. I want to tell you, though, as boots on the ground emergency manager in Norman County and counties across the state, we have 4 duties: mitigation, preparedness, response, and recovery. But I just want to touch briefly on preparedness. Emergency managers cannot prevent an emergency, but we spend much of our time preparing for an emergency. We perform exercises and drills to prepare our vulnerable communities for emergencies. These preparations take money and time. We cannot properly prepare a community without adequate funding. Thus, we leave our communities vulnerable. The burden falls on us if that worst day occurs in our communities and they're not prepared. In the interest of time, I will mention other supporters in lieu of their testimony. We have Carly Stark, who is AMC, or Association of Minnesota Counties, and they have put this on a high priority list. Matt Mawson, Minnesota Intercontinental Association, and Mr. Dan Larson, who's in the crowd, Minnesota Rural Counties, and they put this as a priority. So with that, I think you know the bill. We talked about it last year. I'm open for questions.
Very well. Are there any questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this question is to Representative Marquardt. So I just did some napkin math, and if we have 102 jurisdictions that would receive this funding, it ends up being $27,412 per jurisdiction. What happens to those jurisdictions who may not what happens to the funding for those jurisdictions which may not apply? Would those then be available for redistribution or re-requests? Just some logistics stuff relative to how the granting program may work.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, I'm informed that would go back into the pot. And one other thing I hadn't mentioned is that there is a report due, so all the counties or entities that would get this grant would have to report what they used the grant for. So there is accountability also on knowing what would be done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mark Court, thank you for doing this. For those of you who don't know, I am a co-author on this bill. Former emergency manager myself for a small town. I was appointed by the mayor, had to do all the work without any compensation, but it was important work that needed to be done. In a lot of our small cities, they have the same thing, no compensation for them. But when the things go bad, it's the emergency management crew that the plans they put forward and the resources they have that help their community. And we need to do what we can to assist them.
Very well. Are there any other questions? If not, then Representative Marquardt, any final words of encouragement?
Mr. Chair, thank you so much for hearing this. And this would make a significant difference. Even the $29,000 that would go out would almost double the budget for Norman County. So it's not like there's a lot of money in this area, and these are the folks that are on the front lines that are going to deal with our emergencies. Hopefully it doesn't occur, but to be prepared. So thank you very much.
It's a very important bill. Thank you, Chairman Marquardt. Thank you, Mr. Johansson, for your
thank you, Chair.
Presence. And are you driving back this evening?
Driving back right now, back to Fargo-Moorhead.
Safe drive, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you,
Chair,
Mr. Chairman.
Chair lays over House File 1273 as mentioned. Representative Baker, House File 2901. The chair moves House File 2901 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We will be as quick as we can be. We've trimmed this down a bit here, too. So we want to talk a little bit about just piggybacking a little bit about what Representative Marquardt wants to do with building up kind of an infrastructure for our volunteer operations when we have what's called a low urgent event in our areas that we've had some flooding in rural Minnesota, and the Minnesota Council of Foundations brought this to me late last year. This is just a very small bill that we'd like to have considered as it moves forward. I'll have their testifiers talk about this in a minute, but we just need to build up some backbone to make our volunteers still be volunteers as it goes ahead. But we need some leadership and training so when there is an event, we've got folks ready to go. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Well, thank you.
Hi. Thank you, Representative Baker. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Ruth Telford. I am on the board of Minnesota Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster, also known as MnVOAD. I'm here to ask for your support on this bill, as it would, first of all, provide funding to staff MnVOAD with a single position, thus creating more reliable and consistent partner for the state and communities impacted by disaster, and two, would also provide grants to develop more local volunteer resources across the state so there's more consistent capacity to respond to low-attention disasters in Minnesota. So first let me explain Minnesota VOAD, or MnVOAD. It is an association of over 30 member organizations that do voluntary disaster response. We are written into the state's emergency operations plan, and when there's a large disaster, we have a designated seat at the State Emergency Operations Center. The reason for that is that MnBOAD serves a critical role in coordinating all of these organizations that I mentioned, as well as various community partners, and provide disaster relief throughout Minnesota. Also, because our diverse set of organizations and years of experience, we are able to help local emergency managers identify needs and resources for community recovery. There are a variety of services that Minnesota VOAD member agencies provide, everything from the immediate stages, such as feeding and sheltering, to early recovery, which is like the cleanup, debris removal, and long-term recovery, which can include home rebuild and long-term emotional spiritual care and case management. But beyond coordinating our members, MnBOAD is also critical in mobilizing the community in disaster response. Following a disaster, local communities do react, wanting to help their neighbors with spontaneous volunteers and donations. And these donations and volunteers are a great resource, but without experienced leadership and coordination beyond the scope of our wonderful emergency managers, such valuable resources can go to waste or create problems. Many MnBOAD members are able to engage and oversee previously unaffiliated volunteers, as well as help ensure that donations are collected, documented, and distributed in an equitable manner to those in the most need. However, we do have a number of challenges that have been increasingly affecting our ability to serve Minnesota in times of disaster. First of all, Minnesota VOAD's leadership is entirely voluntary, and as such, our leaders are often pulled in other directions for our day jobs and have limited capacity to invest in capacity building, or as Representative Baker said, building this backbone. And also due to our leader turnover, there's been some inconsistency with some of our recent disasters. And since we are prone to low attention disasters here in Minnesota, which means that there aren't tons of big media coverage here, many of our valuable resources are regularly being deployed to bigger disasters across the country. And as my associate here, Nancy Fashing, will soon share, recent disaster efforts or recovery efforts have demonstrated that volunteer capacity, particularly in our rural areas, is declining. And without our consistent leadership, it is difficult to engage new volunteers on the fly. Lastly, we are seeing rapid changes in our Minnesota demographics, particularly here in our metro areas and many of our farming communities. And in order to best reflect the communities we are serving, time and energy is needed to be invested in engaging more diverse pools of volunteers before disasters strike again. This bill, House File 2901, has a tremendous potential to help us address these challenges by establishing consistent and reliable MnBOAD leadership in the form of paid staff, enabling us to build up our infrastructure and engaging local volunteers and donations, and investing in rebuilding pools of volunteers across the state, as well as engaging new voluntary organizations to better reflect Minnesota's diversity and more accurately address the needs of our more vulnerable populations. So I think I'll turn it over in the interest of time.
Thank you, Ms. Telford. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Fashing, and I'm the Vice President of Community Impact at the Southwest Initiative Foundation. This bill was developed by the Minnesota Council on Foundations Disaster Philanthropy Working Group in coordination with Minnesota VOAD after studying Minnesota's disaster system gaps and opportunities. So Minnesota grant makers support this bill. I'm here to talk today about the Southwest Minnesota flood that happened in 2018. This was a low attention disaster that impacted several counties in Southwest Minnesota, including Lyon, Murray, Cottonwood, Redwood, Renville, with a significant rain event that happened one July morning, really close to actually the 4th of July weekend. So many volunteers wanted to help after this disaster from all across the state, but there was no capacity to track the immediate individual needs with the volunteers who wanted to help coordinate the timing and the talent
of this response. There were also specialized needs with what had happened in people's homes. Many people had mold mitigation that they needed someone to help handle, and many people aren't experts in mold mitigation, I being one of those. But volunteers and nonprofits are critical to our disaster recovery system. This bill will help individuals and families across our state recover from disasters, including those in low-attention areas like Greater Minnesota and other events that happen across our state, especially when there's other disasters happening across the nation. So this bill will provide a coordination and connection for those in need with those that have the capacity to help them with their need.
Thank you, Ms. Fashling, and thank you, Ms. Coffey, Representative Baker. I believe there's an amendment to your bill, and I think Representative O'Neill may have a motion regarding that.
Yes, I move the A20-0604.
Well, Representative O'Neill moves the A20-604. And Representative Baker, quickly, the amendment.
What the amendment does, Mr. Chair and members, is actually reduce it. It removes the subcommittee. We don't need a study group to talk about this. It takes it out, cleans it out, makes this bill very clean. And we're just looking for a little bit of dollars to hire one person and actually get some possible grant money out to the emergency centers in all of Minnesota. So it really simplifies this, and there's no subcommittee to talk about.
Very well. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. House File 2901 is before us as amended. Representative Baker, we're out of time. You get the last few seconds here.
Thank you very much for this. This is a great bill, and Mr. Chair, I look forward to working with you as this progresses in your overall bill. So thank you very much for your time.
I agree it is an important bill, and I want to thank particularly Ms. Fashling. I suspect you live out where the Southwest Initiative Foundation is located.
I do.
Is it Marshall? Or?
Where our headquarters are in Hutchinson. Okay. I was in Marshall on Tuesday, ahead of the blizzard.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much for being both of you being here with us. So the chair will lay over House File 2901. Members, that concludes our business for today. Good conversation on emergency responders day things, and look forward to our hearings next week. With that, this committee stands adjourned.